Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, November 13th, 2024. We have five cases on our calendar today, three of which are set for oral argument. This is the second one. This is A24-0447, State of Minnesota versus Brandon Adam Potter. I'm joined here by my colleagues, Judge Renee Werke and Judge Edward Cleary. We will have 15 minutes for arguments by appellant, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. The podium can be raised or lowered, depending on your height. Please make sure when you are talking, you are speaking directly into the microphone. This is being recorded and is also being live streamed. The audio recording will be available to the parties within a few days after oral argument. And I think that covers everything. Appellant's attorney, when you are ready, feel free to approach the podium, state your name for the record, and the party you are representing. You may begin.
May it please the court, I am Samuel Beisman, a law student practitioner, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Brandon Potter. We are here because Officer Joe Burns of the Hibbing Police Department did not procure an arrest warrant for Mr. Potter. In fact, Officer Burns has never obtained an arrest warrant in his 9 years of police work, nor has he ever received training on how to procure an arrest warrant from the Hibbing Police Department. This essential safeguard against unreasonable searches and seizures is aimed squarely at preventing the two Fourth Amendment violations that make up the heart of this case: an arrest lacking probable cause and a warrantless arrest inside the home. I raised two issues in briefs before the court. First, the trial court erred in determining that Officer Burns had probable cause to arrest Mr. Potter for possession of the Dianowicz apartment drugs upon the self-serving and uncorroborated statements of Bryce Duncan and Alyssa Stutzman. Second, the trial court erred in ruling that both the exigency and consent exceptions to the warrant requirement justified Officer Burns's warrantless arrest of Mr. Potter inside of his home. This is the issue I would like to focus on in oral arguments today. First, the state did not meet its burden to prove that the exigency exception justified this warrantless arrest when it is undisputed that Officer Burns waited 2 days following the completion of his investigation without procuring an arrest warrant before arresting Mr. Potter inside his home. Second, the state also failed below to prove that the consent exception justifies the warrantless arrest. First, it is undisputed that Mr. Potter himself did not give consent to enter his bedroom. Second, the record does not reflect and demonstrates that the Potter grandparents do not have the actual authority to grant third-party consent to
that. I'm sorry, wasn't that rather late, though? I mean, aren't we beyond that in terms of the time frame of this? Because the grandparents, we acknowledge as far as the facts, the grandparents are saying, gesturing, he's there, demonstrating where the room is. But it's not until Potter is arrested that the grandparents say, that's off limits to me, we can't go in that room. I mean, what difference would that make because he's already arrested?
Well, Your Honor, that's relevant to the inquiry of the apparent authority that the grandparents had to grant third-party consent, but it is not relevant in terms of the actual authority that the Potter grandparents had to grant third-party consent to grant this space. As the Minnesota Supreme Court describes in cases like Lacare, the actual consent analysis to third-party consent rests on determining if a third party has common authority to search a space based on a finding of mutual use, which is something more than just a right of mutual access. This relies on the actual objective facts as the case, and not as they appeared to the officer. Even though you are correct in saying that the Potter grandparents made these statements, that they did not use, much less even access, Mr. Potter's bedroom until after the arrest, it still demonstrates that for the actual consent authority, these third parties did not make mutual use of the room, and they did not even have mutual access. So regarding this portion of the third party consent inquiry, the state did not meet their burden to show that it justifies the arrest. Furthermore,
what are the facts showing that that the grandparents did not have that mutual authority to provide consent that were available to the officer prior to entering appellant's bedroom?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, where I'd slightly push back on your description of the standard here is that it's not the defense's burden to show that the officer did not have facts available to them that would disprove the existence of third-party consent. It is the state's burden to prove that the facts available to the officer granted them or appeared to be third-party consent under a valid interpretation of the law. And when we analyze the facts that both Officer Burns had and the trial judge below made their ruling upon, we can see that neither suffice to meet Minnesota's standard for mutual use to establish third-party consent. As Officer Burns testified, the facts that he had available to him that established his third-party consent were, first, that there was a parental relationship between the Potter grandparents and Mr. Potter himself, and second, that the grandparents owned the home. Under the mutual use standard, in multiple decisions that this court has already decided, and in other jurisdictions that also use the mutual use standard, including the DC Circuit and New Mexico, these facts alone do not establish that a parent makes mutual use of their adult child's private bedroom. If we had other facts on the record, such as that one of the...
Do we even know, at the time when the officer was heading to the downstairs, do we even know that it was a bedroom? I mean, at that time, did he have knowledge? I don't recall in the briefing or the transcripts that there was any statement, his bedroom is downstairs. Wasn't it just directing him, he's down there, or something like that?
Yes, but the record reflects that Officer Burns understood this place as Mr. Potter's bedroom. Throughout the transcript, Your Honor, and I believe page 47 and other places, he continually refers to the place he's being led to as his room, his bedroom. Additionally, there's other evidence.
Well, his room, but where does he state that it was his bedroom?
I would argue that...
I recall seeing his room. Statements from the officer that it was his room, but were there any explicit statements by the officer that it was his bedroom, i.e. Potter's bedroom?
On the record, I believe so, Your Honor. I may have to reference the record and bring this up to you on rebuttal, but...
Which is fine. You need to do that.
Yes, but he does refer to it as his room, and within the context, that demonstrates an understanding that the room is a place upon which Mr. Potter has an independent expectation of privacy, regardless of it being inside of a house that the Potter grandparents own. At page 29 in the transcript, it reflects that Burns refers to the room as, quote unquote, his room. I think the distinguishing adjective as a specifically bedroom is not dispositive of the fact that Mr. Potter did not have an independent expectation of privacy in this room.
Okay, so that's consistent with my recollection that he refers to it as his room, but not his bedroom.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But additionally, there are other facts that suggest that Officer Burns knew that this was his bedroom. First of all, the record reflects that Officer Burns had prior interactions with Mr. Potter inside at this residence. Additionally, the record also reflects that Mr. Potter knew that Officer Burns...
Wait, go back to that first statement you said. Burns had interactions with Potter at that residence?
Yes, the record reflects that in a prior occasion, Officer Burns interacted with Mr. Potter in the backyard outside the
not
residence.
Not in what's now the bedroom.
Not in what's the bedroom, Your
At
Honor.
The premises.
We know that he understood Mr. Potter's relation to the premises, yes.
And not in the house itself, correct?
The record does not reflect that, Your Honor.
Okay.
But what I'd also like to point out is that Officer Burns' knowledge of if this was a bedroom or not is arguably irrelevant to the legal analysis here, because we still have to apply the law accurately, regardless of what the facts Mr. Burns might have known. What the court directs us to do in the apparent authority inquiry in cases like Licari is look to the facts as the officer understood them, but we still must apply the law as is accurate. If we did so otherwise and used the apparent authority exception to justify any sort of search where the officer believed that they were sufficing the legal standard for third-party consent, any search that an officer believed met this standard would suffice under this exception, and it would make this exception irrelevant under the law. Here, the facts that Mr. Potter knew, the facts that Officer Burns knew about the grandparents' residence to the space are relevant to his apparent authority. But the fact of the space itself and how the law applies to it is irrelevant in this inquiry. If so, Officer Burns, or any third party for that matter, could be deceived into believing from a third party that a space is simply not what it is under the law. And by that logic, any deceptive third party could satisfy this standard for an officer. And finally, on the consent inquiry, even if the state is able to prove to you that the grandparents had either the actual or apparent authority to consent to this search, Officer Burns still exceeded the scope of the consent granted to him by the third parties in this case. As the Supreme Court directs us in cases like Jimeno, the scope of a consent to search from a third party is still limited by the expressed object of that search. Here, there is nothing in the record that shows that the grandparents gave Officer Burns the authority or consent to enter Mr. Potter's bedroom. What he explicitly asks for upon arriving at the Potter grandparents' residence is to talk to Mr. Potter about a case. He doesn't ask for permission to search his room. He doesn't ask for permission to enter his room. And he certainly doesn't ask for permission to enter and make an arrest of Mr. Potter. Rather, he arrives and asks for permission to talk to Mr. Potter.
Doesn't then the knock, the rap at the door before he entered it due to silence, doesn't that also comport with permission to enter?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, the Minnesota Supreme Court is very clear that a lack of consent does not amount to implied consent.
So Potter had said, what? Or something, some kind of a response, would that have been enough?
No, Your Honor, because that still would not have been affirmative consent to enter that space. I think that comparing this case on the scope of authority issue to the Thompson case, which was decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1998, is very instructive on that point. In that case as well, an investigating police officer arrived at a shared apartment and was met by a third party at the door. The officer explicitly asked this third party if he could come in and talk to the suspect he was looking for. The third party led the officers inside and led them specifically to a closed door bedroom. But the crucial distinguishing fact in this case is that the officer in Thompson did not enter the bedroom.
But in this case, the officer didn't enter the bedroom until he saw Potter rolling off the bed, which again goes to the exigent circumstances. What's he rolling off the bed for? Is he looking to hide maybe a weapon, something like that? I mean, isn't that also a factual part of the record that he didn't enter until he rolled off the bed?
Before you answer that, counsel, I want to be clear. There was never, he knocked on the door. No one ever said enter. And then he opened the door without authority, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And to respond to your point, Judge Werke, it's not that the officer Burns in this case somehow saw Mr. Potter in the bedroom. He arrives at the door, knocks. Neither Mr. Potter from the inside nor Gail Potter, the grandparent standing at the top of the stairs, says anything. He waits for about 6 seconds and then opens the door of his own accord. That's when he sees Mr. Potter starting to roll off the bed and put his hands up. This is established both in the suppression hearing transcript, and it's also available in the admitted body cam footage that the state introduced at the hearing. And I think that's why cases like Pullen and Dizzo are so instructive on your point about the lack of consent, because these cases are explicit that failure to stop a police officer or failure to deny consent does not amount to a question or does not amount to implied consent. And other cases from the Minnesota Supreme Court, like Wills, direct us to construe the implied consent inquiry extremely narrowly, so that way we don't overreach into the conduct of others when granting consent by to the state to make searches or seizures. Thus, two things are clear from this analysis. First, as it relates to the scope of authority, the officer was clearly outside of the scope of authority, and thus, even if he had the actual or apparent authority, he still exceeded the scope of his search. And second, this cannot contribute to an expression of consent by the Potter grandparents to search the room. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. The clock is on the podium, and feel free to adjust the podium up and down. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, my name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. Appellant said a couple of times, talks about that the state's burden is to convince you that the officer did this correctly. This is an appeal from a stipulated fact hearing under 2601 subdivision 4. Your review is limited to determine whether the district court properly denied appellant suppression motion. I don't need to convince you that the court got it right. He needs to convince you that the district court judge got it wrong. So he has the burden of convincing you that the district court judge erred in this case. The district court relied almost exclusively on State v. Thompson. In my brief, I rely on State v. Thompson and State v. Powell.
Well, let's talk about Thompson, counsel. To me, that is so easily distinguishable from this case that I find it hard to believe that it's used in support of your argument. That's a plain view case, correct?
Correct.
Okay. There's no opening of a door without consent, without somebody saying enter.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. That alone, to me, suggests it's not applicable. This officer knocked on the door, which arguably is an expectation of privacy recognition, is it not? When someone knocks on a door, isn't that a recognition? I can't just come in here, I'm knocking.
From the officers, but it's an objective standard of review for the court here today.
Okay. So to me, that's an objective recognition of privacy by knocking on the door. And now I don't wait for a response, and I enter that door. That distinguishes it from Thompson. If you can convince me otherwise, I'd love to hear it.
Apparent authority. Did the officer have reason to believe, based on the interactions he had had with the grandparents, who are not only the owners, but the occupants of this home, did he have reason to believe that he could knock on that door and then open it? Yes. Watch the video.
Let's break it down, though. I think there are two aspects, and I think I want to make sure we're not conflating them. One is the officer's ability to knock on the door. And I don't think that's opposing counsel can correct me, but I don't think that's disputed, that the officer certainly had the authority to knock on the door, consent to knock on the door. I think what's at issue is whether or not he had the authority without a warrant to open the door. Can you please address that?
These are almost always very fact dependent. And here we have the body cam footage. I've watched it multiple times. I watched it yesterday. I've watched it this morning. You can listen to what the grandmother says and how she specifically directs him down the basement. He goes down the basement on the left. He sees a closed door. He walks past the closed door and she stops him. And she says, no, right there. She's telling appellant isn't right there. He has to do more in order to get to the appellant. He's following her directions right there. That means he's somewhere on the other side of that door. This could lead to another hallway. It could lead to a hallway that goes back to where a laundry room is. It could lead to a rec room. It could lead to any other number of places. But she's telling him right there. And when he walks past it, she directs him back to it again. So he knocks on it, and then he opens the door.
But he understood that that was his room, according to his own testimony, the officer's testimony.
Well, I don't know how much of that is colored by his after-the-fact knowledge. At the time...
Well, we have to take what his statement is. Why can't we take his statement at face value, that he knew that that was his room?
There's no evidence in the record that he's been in that house before with the appellant and knows and been in that room and knows that that's his room. It may be a supposition.
Why isn't that a rational assumption based on the grandparents telling him and directing him directly to where appellant is supposedly residing?
Well, it's shortly before 8 o'clock. You're watching the video, the sun's still up. This isn't 10 o'clock where you'd expect somebody to be in their bedroom.
Would he expect that
this would inevitably be leading him to his bedroom? I don't think that's in the record here that would support that. So it's based on what the officer knows at the time and based on the directions that he's received from the grandmother, is he exceeding her scope? And at no time does she tell him no. And
she's never giving him the authority to go ahead. You can go into that room. He is in that room. Feel free to go into that room. That is not part of the record, correct?
Yes, because he walks past the door and she stops him,
right, but
and
she
directs him back to it.
She directs him to the door, but she never tells him, feel free to go through that door. Feel free to enter into that door, correct?
She's told him she's going to lead the officer to the appellant. He's downstairs.
To do what?
To talk to him.
Okay.
He goes down the stairs. He's not there. He walks past the door. No, there. The grandmother knows what the officer is there to do. He tells them to talk to appellant. I want to talk to the appellant. So.
But he never says, I'm here to arrest appellants. I need to find appellant so I can.
That's correct. Okay. That is correct.
So talking to somebody is very different than saying, I'm here to arrest someone.
That's correct. Yes.
So if you're going to arrest somebody, then you need to actually be in physical contact.
Yes.
Which segues into the next question for me, at least. The state's argument is that the statements of the Duncan and Stutzma led to probable cause to arrest the appellant, as did the circumstantial evidence from the Fairview apartments. Given that, for 48 hours, nobody bothers to get an arrest warrant. Can you explain that?
There's nothing in the record that explains that.
Okay. So I have a hard time, given that hard fact, even analyzing under Dorman, an argument for exigent circumstances. Do you want to try to make one?
Well, the district court made a...
I know, I read the district court's findings.
Yes, and I think the district court's determination is defensible.
Well, they mentioned Gray in there, and Gray was a 90-minute wait, not 48 hours. Where's that line drawn as to the unreasonableness of it?
No factor is overriding in the multiple circumstance. 90 minutes in that case, it's just one factor versus the 2 days here. None of it is overriding. It's just looking at the totality of the circumstances. The judge did that here and made the determination that the exigency applied.
The judge also found Thompson in support, which I have a hard time understanding. So there's a few things I don't understand in the findings. So exigent by its very definition would suggest something quite different than 48 hours with probable cause to arrest someone with no record of them avoiding arrest, with no attempt to arrest, no attempt to get a warrant. It all leads to this knock on the door. When I look under Dorman factors, I don't see what you see, but I'll listen to any arguments you want to make.
You're wearing the robe. I'm making the arguments to you. I can believe it all I want. If you're not inclined to go along with it, there's very little that I'm going to say here today that's probably going to change it. But did the judge abuse her discretion here when she made this determination? I don't believe so.
Is it abuse of discretion standard? I thought we actually review the Dorman factors de novo.
Oh, yes, you're correct. Okay. Yes, on the exigent circumstances. Okay. Yes, I conflated that. I apologize for that.
Thank you.
But on the State v. Thompson, I think this does fit in there. The police officer does not know at that time that he is knocking on his bedroom. Appellant could have said, hold on, or could have said anything, but he doesn't say anything. He leaves the officer in this limbo land. And both Powell and Thompson talk about, again, under the Fourth Amendment, the overriding concern is, did the officer act reasonably? And when you watch this video, I think that's the conclusion that the court made below, and I think that's a conclusion that this court can make today. The officer acted reasonably based on his interactions with the grandparents. He knocked on the door, got no response, got no indication from the grandmother. He opens the door. Now he sees him, and it's reasonable. His actions from that point on are reasonable. So I think it does fit within the confines of Thompson.
You don't see that as an extension of Thompson?
Well, in Thompson, on the one hand, when he looks in and sees him, he knows that's a bedroom. That's a distinguishing that makes that case more difficult.
Well, he stands outside the bedroom door and asked if Thompson was there, to someone else, third party. Then I spoke to somebody in another bedroom and said, is Thompson there? And then he asked her, I think it's her, to come out. And she did that, right? She got out of bed and approached, and he can see in the doorway that's okay. Here, there was no request for him to come out. At least I didn't see that in the record. There was no response whatsoever. And the officer took the affirmative action of opening the door. To me, what you're asking us for to do is to extend Thompson for law enforcement, to suggest that that's okay.
This is a very fact-particular case, and almost all of these cases are very fact-particular. I don't think that if you affirm the district court, I don't think you're giving police officers carte blanche to do whatever they want when they're inside a house. This case is very fact-specific. It turns on how the grandparents interacted in this case with the police officer. And we also have the benefit of the body cam footage. We can look at it. The officer act reasonably based on the directions that he got from the grandmother? Yes.
So I'm living with my grandparents. I've got a bedroom in their home. Police come. Grandparents say, go to that. And the officer says, I want to talk to Peter Reyes. And the grandparents say, oh, go to that room. No, down that hall. Okay, go to that room right there. And they knock. And I don't want to talk to the police. So I don't answer. I don't respond. I'm struggling with how police would have the authority without a warrant to enter into my room when they know that that is my room. It seems to, I'm struggling with the how that's objectively reasonable. That it would be different, I think, if I said to them, come on in, or feel free to open the door, or something like that, giving them consent. But I'm struggling with how just the grandparents pointing them in the direction of that room gives police the authority without a warrant to enter into my room.
Once, so the police officer had probable cause to arrest you in that case, in your hypothetical.
Let's assume that for the sake
that they have probable cause to arrest you. So if they see you, they can place you under arrest. This is a felony.
If they see me.
Right. So they open the door.
But the consent to open the door is the key issue here, I think. And I think what differentiates that from Thompson and other cases when there's a plain view of the person.
But did Officer Burns have did he believe that the grandparents give him apparent authority to open that door?
To do what?
Well, now that I think about it, in Thompson, the police officers, I don't believe, told anyone that they were there to arrest that suspect either. So there they wanted to talk to this individual. So I think in that regards, Thompson is on all fours with that.
But you're missing the plain view that Thompson has that we don't have here.
I see my time has expired. Can I answer
yes,
your question?
Absolutely.
Thank you. So was the officer in a place he could legally be when he made the observation? He's standing outside of the room. He opens the door and he sees inside the room. And then he goes in, just like in Thompson. He's outside the door, outside the room, when he sees the appellant in this case. In Thompson, it was okay to go in. My time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
What a lot of this case comes down to is the scope of Officer Burns' consent given by the grandparents. Officer Burns had consent to approach Mr. Potter's bedroom and knock, but he did not have the consent to enter his bedroom. Nothing in the interaction, the expressed object of Officer Burns to the Potter grandparents, to simply talk to Mr. Potter, implies or explicitly states that he was asking for consent to enter his bedroom or physically arrest Mr. Potter. And the subjective intention of the police officer in this inquiry does not matter. To quote from the Supreme Court's opinion in Peyton versus New York, the critical point is that any difference in the intrusiveness of entries to search and entries to arrest are merely ones of degrees rather than kind. The two intrusions share the fundamental characteristic that the breach of an entrance to the individual's home. That's why, in cases like Jimeno, it's not relevant as to what the officer's subjective purpose is in establishing the scope of their consent to search, but what the expressed object, the actual conversation between the third party and the officers is in determining their consent to search.
But even in that objective analysis, we can take into account the subjective statements that are made by the officer, correct?
What do you mean by subjective statements?
Well, I think the statements by the officers are inherently subjective, aren't they? Because it's the officer's perspective versus taking a look on our own to see, to determine whether or not the conduct was reasonable.
I don't think so, Your Honor. As Jimeno directs, this is an objective inquiry. What we're looking at is what was objectively said and what was objectively expressed to the third party when the officer was asking for consent.
Well, I think we might be talking past each other because you actually talked about what he objectively said. I mean, we can take into account what the officer said, correct, and what he testified to, and the district court can, right?
When determining the scope of consent, what we are looking for is on the scene what the officer said to the third party. And to the extent that in the testimony, what we have establishing what the parties said back and forth to each other is what the officer said at the suppression hearing. By that token, we can take into account what the officer said at the suppression hearing in determining what this was. But the officer's subjective intent of what they want to do is irrelevant in determining their scope of consent. And this is logical under Fourth Amendment principles, Your Honor, because what we're looking for here is when the consent of a third party makes a search reasonable. And that consent is established by the state asking for authority to do things and parties giving that consent to the state to do things. That's why we look at the explicit interaction between these parties objectively, and our analysis doesn't take us into what the subjective purpose of the officer here is in establishing their scope of consent. Additionally, to return to the issue of if the officer knew that this was a bedroom or not, I think, first of all, it bears repeating that the record reflects that Officer Burns understood this as quote-unquote his room as he was moving to the bedroom. Additionally, I think that Judge Clary makes a great point in that the state is asking us to make an equal assumption rather than that it wasn't a bedroom, that it was a common area of the household to which the Potter grandparents made mutual use of and thus had the common authority to grant to a third party search. To the extent that either inference requires this court to make an affirmative assumption, the evidence on the record much better demonstrates that Officer Burns would have understood this as a bedroom, considering his prior interaction with Mr. Potter, his knowledge that Mr. Potter lived there for extended periods of time, and just the general layout of the house. With that, we ask you to reverse the lower court's determination to admit the evidence procured as the fruit of this illegal arrest, and with it, reverse Mr. Potter's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. By the way, counsel, is this the first time you have argued before this court?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Congratulations, and I think the future is in very good hands, particularly when you are going up against one of the finest attorneys that the state has. So congratulations, and thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing. Of course, very well done. We appreciate that, and we will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame.
Thank you, Your Honor.